The Trophy Council, welcome to today's training, Petroleum Vapor Intrusion, Fundamentals of Screening, Investigation, and Management. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Petroleum Vapor Intrusion Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC team. Today's training is based on the Petroleum Vapor Intrusion Technical and Regulatory Guidance. This is a web-based document. We're going to introduce you to the document during today's training class, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training. Today's class is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC. A few housekeeping items to cover as we get started. We're scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording today's training. During today's class, the trainers control the slides. If you would like to control your own slides, you can download the presentation, and that's back on that Clue-In training page where we started today. We do look for your questions and feedback. Throughout the training class, you are welcome to send in questions using that Q&A box in the lower right. At the question and answer breaks, we are going to ask those questions out loud. If you're on the phone line, you also have the opportunity to ask your own question out loud. At the end of the class, we look for everyone to fill out the feedback form, and you can access that anytime in the middle right, that related URLs. The last item is the feedback. So select feedback, look down a bit, select browse to. That's going to open that feedback form in a new slot, in a new window. If you would like to create a certificate of participation for today's training, you can do that through the feedback form. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended, and the system will create a certificate for you. More information about ITRC is available on the website. It's hosted by ITRC is led by state regulators. Our federal partners include Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. Please credit ITRC and review the ITRC usage policies. Also, let us know about your success. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of guidance documents available, and our training schedule for the rest of this year is available. I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All trainers were members of the ITRC Petroleum Vapor Intrusion Team. That team was led by John Boyer of New Jersey, with co-leader John Minotti of Utah for the guidance development, and with co-leader Matt Williams from Michigan for this online training and two-day classroom training. Robin Mungin is a Federal Sites Program Manager, responsible for CERCLA and DOD waste site cleanup for the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services, where she is the primary point of contact for vapor intrusion issues. George Duvall is a principal technical expert in environmental, soil, and groundwater with Shell Global Solutions in Houston, Texas. His current work includes research and development on chemical fate and transport, risk assessment frameworks and applications, guidance and standards development, and technical consultation. Ian Hurz is a senior associate engineer with Golder Associates, located in Vancouver, British Columbia. He is a technical specialist in the areas of LNAPL and DNAPL source characterization, monitor natural attenuation and source zone depletion, vapor intrusion, and vapor phase in-situ remediation technologies. Lauren Lund is a principal technologist for CH2M Hill in Shelley, Idaho. Lauren is CH2M Hill's vapor intrusion practice leader, responsible for overseeing training staff and ensuring vapor intrusion best practices are applied. David Folks is a principal with GeoSyntech Consultants in Denver, Colorado. He has worked on over 100 vapor intrusion projects and has been extensively involved with development of vapor intrusion practice and guidance. I'll now turn today's presentation over to Robin Mungin at the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Robin?
Thank you, Juliana. Good afternoon, everyone. This slide presents our roadmap for today's training class. I'm going to start things off by providing a brief introduction on today's class and present some general concepts that will be discussed in more detail as the class progresses. We will have sections presented by various speakers on the petroleum vapor intrusion pathway, site screening, investigation and modeling, and vapor control and site management. We will also discuss community engagement which can happen at any time throughout the process, and then we'll wrap things up. First, we want to define vapor intrusion. Vapor intrusion is defined by the US EPA as the migration of vapors through the vado zone into an overlying building. There are basically two types of vapor intrusion that can occur. Petroleum vapor intrusion, or PVI, dealing exclusively with petroleum hydrocarbons, which is why we're here today. Example would be gasoline or even a particular compound in gasoline such as benzene. And then we have chlorinated vapor intrusion, or CVI, which deals with chlorinated solvents, the most common of which are PCE, or tetrachloroethylene, and TCE, or trichloroethylene. Now, the major difference between these two, petroleum vapor intrusion and chlorinated vapor intrusion, is aerobic biodegradation. Aerobic biodegradation is the key to limiting the potential for petroleum vapor intrusion. Aerobic biodegradation is the breakdown of organic contaminants by microorganisms. This occurs in the vado zone, where there is an adequate supply of oxygen present. These microorganisms consist of petroleum hydrocarbon degrading bacteria, which are ubiquitous in nature and can be found in all different types of environments. These microorganisms rapidly consume petroleum hydrocarbons in the presence of oxygen. This minimizes the migration of petroleum vapors towards a structure and therefore reduces the potential for vapor intrusion to occur. The effect of aerobic biodegradation for petroleum hydrocarbons is huge. If you took the entire universe of petroleum hydrocarbon sites, most sites will screen out, requiring no further evaluation. Certain sites that do not screen out will require an investigation, but even after the investigation, only a few will remain requiring mitigation. So the bottom line, aerobic biodegradation leads to only a small fraction of petroleum hydrocarbon sites requiring some type of vapor control. So the key point here is that the majority of petroleum hydrocarbon sites are likely going to screen out. And also the need for mitigation at petroleum hydrocarbon sites is going to be significantly less than for chlorinated solvent sites. So what's the big deal with petroleum vapor intrusion? Well, essentially, there's been a lack of guidance and training for PVI. Much of the existing training and guidance documents apply mainly to chlorinated vapor intrusion and do not consider aerobic biodegradation, which, again, is a very important aspect to understand when dealing with petroleum hydrocarbon sites. We all know that there are a lot of petroleum hydrocarbon sites out there. For brownfields or other redevelopment sites where you have a petroleum hydrocarbon issue, you will want a vapor intrusion assessment tailored specifically for petroleum hydrocarbons so that you avoid costly property transaction delays due to unnecessary investigations or the installation of unnecessary vapor controls. The bottom line is that we don't want to waste resources on sites that have little or no potential for petroleum vapor intrusion related risk. This slide introduces the ITRC petroleum vapor intrusion document. This is a web-based document that has many features giving you immediate access to large amount of information ready at fingertips. You have immediate access to fact sheets, reference materials, and a whole host of appendices, and it's very easy to navigate through. The ITRC document can serve as a standalone document, but it also can be used as a companion document to ITRC's 2007 vapor intrusion pathway document, which deals primarily with chlorinated vapor intrusion. It provides valuable updates on methods and vapor control strategies, and it complements EPA's Office of Underground Storage Tank petroleum vapor intrusion guidance. However, the ITRC petroleum vapor intrusion guidance document addresses a much larger universe of petroleum hydrocarbon sites, where EPA's OUSH document is limited to underground storage tanks. The petroleum vapor intrusion screening method identified in this document is based on a vertical screening distance. Using this method is intended to make consistent decisions that are protective of human health, minimize investigative efforts at sites where there is little risk of petroleum vapor intrusion, and prioritize our resources at sites where there is a higher risk for petroleum vapor intrusion. The guidance provides a comprehensive strategy to target resources at those sites where the risk for petroleum vapor intrusion is the greatest. It presents a consistent approach based on a national consensus developed through a large network of state regulators from over 28 states, consultants, DOD, EPA, community stakeholders, and academia. It is scientifically based on the latest available research. It applies to a wide variety of sites, not just underground storage tanks, but also refineries, pipelines. Figure 1-2 presents the petroleum vapor intrusion strategy flowchart. This is one of the handouts you should have received as a download at the beginning of the class. The PVI strategy flowchart presents a stepwise process that includes three phases. The first phase is site screening using the vertical screening distance, followed by a detailed site investigation phase where you refine your conceptual site model, and lastly, vapor controls and site management. Also keep in mind that community engagement can also be a critical component at any site during any time throughout the process. This slide presents ITRC's Petroleum Vapor Intrusion 8-step process. This is another handout that you should have received as a download. It's available in the document as two separate figures, Figure 3-2, Site Screening, and Figure 4-1, Site Investigation. We're going to go through these steps in a lot more detail later in the training class, but we wanted to give you a brief overview of the steps. In general, the first three steps are considered site screening, where you develop a preliminary conceptual site model, evaluate the site for precluding factors, lateral inclusion, and then determine if sites screen out using the vertical separation distance concept. And if the site doesn't screen out, then you would move on to the site investigation phase, which is a five-step process. As I mentioned, the ITRC document is a lot broader than the EPA oust PVI document. Appendix E in the ITRC document summarizes 9 different types of petroleum sites and the different features that may influence the potential for petroleum vapor intrusion at each type of site, where again, the EPA document is very specific to underground storage tank sites. So depending on what type of site you have, you can refer to Appendix E in the guidance. And when Juliana first started the training session, she mentioned the poll question. So it's not like all we deal with is underground storage tank sites. As you can see from the poll that Juliana just reposted, you know, we work on different types of sites, not just underground storage tank sites. And so just to reiterate, the ITRC document does address the broader universe of petroleum hydrocarbon sites, not just underground storage tank sites. Thanks, Juliana. Keep in mind, community engagement can be a critical component that should be considered throughout the petroleum vapor intrusion assessment process. The ITRC document has 4 community engagement fact sheets that were prepared to help at public meetings or to use as handouts. You can use these as presented in the document or as a template to make your own site-specific edits. These are valuable tools that are found in Appendix K, and they include what is PVI, what to expect in a PVI investigation, how is a PVI problem fixed, and is a PVI problem ever over? So after we're done with the training today, you will know how and when to use ITR's PVI document. You will understand the importance that aerobic biodegradation plays in assessing PVI. You will understand the value of a conceptual site model. You will know how to apply the ITRC's PVI 8-step decision process, and you will know when and how to engage with stakeholders. Okay, now we're back to our roadmap for the rest of the training class, and I'm going to turn things over to George Duval with Shell.
Thank you, Robin. This next section is on the petroleum vapor intrusion pathway. We're going to cover some technical information, some background information on petroleum vapor intrusion here. And I'm trying to move the slides. There we go. So in terms of what we're covering here, the ideas include the conceptual site model, the key components of the conceptual site model, and this biodegradation that's already been introduced, some of the information around what we know about biodegradation of petroleum vapors. I'm also going to cover so we're going to cover the basics of vapor intrusion and vapor flow. I'm going to make some comparisons between petroleum vapor intrusion and chlorinated vapor intrusion. We're going to cover some information around biodegradation in petroleum vapors, the evidence that we have for that biodegradation occurring, and how important oxygen is to that biodegradation. We do have some data in this section, and we're also going to cover this petroleum vapor intrusion conceptual site model. I'm going to start with that conceptual site model. This slide illustrates in the cartoons on the right several examples of conceptual site model for petroleum vapor intrusion. The picture here is that this model includes four compartments or components. They are the building or the building envelope, the foundation separating the building from the subsurface soil, a layer of soil below the foundation, and this source of the vapors at some distance from the foundation. Now in this slide, there's a number of different factors listed for each of these compartments, any of which could attenuate or reduce the vapors getting from the subsurface to indoor air. The one we're focusing on significantly is this aerobic biodegradation, and that's primarily because it's pretty ubiquitous, occurs nearly everywhere, and the attenuation is really significant, and that's why we're spend a lot of time on it. Now, there's a number of different ways for vapors to get inside a building. These are covered in other conceptual models or other mechanisms, things like on this slide, bringing contaminated water inside a building, from consumer products or household activities, all of which could generate vapors inside a building. We're essentially not covering those in this evaluation or in this vapor intrusion presentation. And when we're working on sites, there's other impacts at sites we can be worried about, soil contamination, groundwater contamination, and so forth. Also not covered here. We're just focused on this subsurface to indoor air vapor intrusion. Now this next slide, one of the things, should be a poll here. One of the things that I'd introduced was I was going to make some comparisons of petroleum vapor intrusion to chlorinated vapor intrusion, and chlorinated, I mean, dry cleaning solvents, things like TCE and PCE. And this poll is gauging your experience with it, so I'll use that in terms of, I'm going to go ahead and go to the next slide. Where we are making a comparison in a table and some graphs here, or plots here, between chlorinated vapor intrusion and petroleum vapor intrusion. The figures themselves are coming out of an EPA note. Worth looking at it short, gives some concise information. But the big picture here, looking at the plots, is that the main difference between the petroleum vapor intrusion and the chlorinated vapor intrusion is that it's for the petroleum, the vapor plume's a lot smaller, and it's surrounded by this aerobic biodegradation zone between the petroleum vapor and the oxygen in the subsurface. And it's this aerobic biodegradation and the presence of this degradation zone that's responsible for the significant attenuation for petroleum vapor intrusion. That's not happening with the chlorinated vapor intrusion. And so in terms of looking at this biodegradation and biodegradation of petroleum, we do know that it occurs reliably in soils. The microorganisms capable of degrading petroleum are everywhere, ubiquitous. When petroleum does degrade, it begins relatively rapidly, occurs fast once it gets started. And where we have oxygen, this occurs really rapidly. Now, that occurs, that biodegradation occurs, is pretty widely recognized. There's a number of EPA documents referring to biodegradation petroleum here. There's also many, hundreds if not thousands of peer-reviewed publications of petroleum biodegradation. What we're doing here is incorporating this into the practical evaluation of petroleum vapor intrusion. So going to that biodegradation, the basics essentially are that we're starting with petroleum and oxygen. Microbes degrade that. They produce mineral products, carbon dioxide and water, and more microbes. In a pretty simple diagram, and this is really what we're attributing this attenuation of the vapors to. Now, in terms of looking at the conceptual model and the key factors, there's really only a few key factors that are important. One of them is the concentrations of the vapors at the source. Another one is how far those vapors have to move in the subsurface in the soil to get to the potential receptor, the building foundation. And the third one is actually having oxygen in that zone where in the soil zone where the degradation is occurring. Now I'm going to step through the compartments in this conceptual site model, talking about aspects of each one, starting with the vapor source. And what we have with petroleum vapor, what we have with hydrocarbons, is a range of different hydrocarbon products. In terms of looking at the products where we have the maximum potential for petroleum vapor intrusion, we have some limits. And at the high end, here at about what we're calling carbon number 12, above that, hydrocarbon constituents aren't very volatile. They have low vapor pressure. There's not much vapor. Lighter than about on this graph, C5 or so, the hydrocarbons are so volatile that they don't persist. We got this zone in the middle, a sweet spot, where the hydrocarbon chemicals are both volatile and persistent enough to worry about in terms of petroleum vapor intrusion. And the products that fall right in that range are primarily gasoline. If we move up in this conceptual model from the source into the soil zone, what we're illustrating here on the left is a diagram of essentially that soil zone. What we have is hydrocarbons at the bottom, high hydrocarbon concentrations, at the top, high oxygen concentrations. What's happening as those come together is with oxygen and hydrocarbons in the same place, we get a lot of aerobic biodegradation, where this aerobic biodegradation front's illustrated. Now, in terms of looking at different types of sources, low concentration sources, high concentration sources, where we have low concentration sources, the aerobic biodegradation front would occur deeper in the soil layer, farther away from the surface. There's more zone where the oxygen is present, greater potential for the hydrocarbons to get attenuated before they get to the surface. Where you have higher hydrocarbon concentrations, that aerobic biodegradation front will occur closer to the surface, shallower, and there's less distance over which the hydrocarbons degrade and attenuate, and there can be even cases where that aerobic biodegradation front intersects the soil surface. Those are the ones we're most worried about in terms of potential vapor intrusion issues. And looking at this in more detail, this is a plot of data. It's showing the relationship between oxygen and petroleum vapors. for oxygen. What we're seeing on this graph is high oxygen at the surface decreases as we get deeper. As a surrogate for the petroleum vapors, looking at benzene, we have high benzene concentrations at depth, and they attenuate relatively rapidly, in this case around 4 or 5 feet. And it's this inverse relationship and this disappearance of the hydrocarbons that we're attributing to biodegradation. Now, this is one plot amongst many. What we can do with this data and with other data is back out some rates as to how fast that degradation is actually occurring. And this plot illustrates that. This plot is in the ITRC guide. There's actually a lot of information on this graph. What it's shown essentially is that there's a lot of data out there, a lot of information on the rates of degradation, and for the purpose of this presentation, those rates are relatively fast. If you want more information on this plot on the degradation, I'd refer you to the ITRC guide. But the big picture really is that with these rates in aerobic soils, what we can see is some pretty significant petroleum vapor attenuation over relatively short distances. For most of the data, for most of the information we got, this is might be a factor of 2 degrees in 5 to 50 centimeters. For geometric increases in those distances, it's not a half life; it's more like a half distance. That's also proportionate. So this can be pretty relatively rapid. Attenuation with distance in the soils. Now, to actually get that, we do need oxygen in the subsurface. That oxygen's coming from the atmosphere. There's actually a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere. If we take 21% oxygen, use the ratio of normal ratio of hydrocarbon to oxygen consumption, we get estimates of the oxygen in the air can degrade about 92 million micrograms per cubic meter of hydrocarbon vapors, so pretty high. And the issue here is, not that it can degrade. There's plenty of oxygen. It's that can the oxygen actually get into the subsurface? There's things that can limit oxygen into the subsurface, transport through and around building foundations. Diffusion rates through soil can be limited by high moisture or low permeability. And we can also limit the oxygen in the subsurface by the oxygen demand, either from the hydrocarbons we're talking about or other organic material in the soil. With those factors, generally asking the question, is there enough oxygen in the subsurface to support biodegradation? Generally, there is. I mean, we can have instances with high hydrocarbons close to the building where there are issues, but generally, we're going to have enough oxygen in the subsurface. Now I'm going to wrap this up, returning to the conceptual site model. It's revised in this figure, similar to what we had before, except in this case, we're including this oxygen, the oxygen diffusing from the subsurface downward, and this aerobic biodegradation zone separating the petroleum vapors from the high oxygen zone in the subsurface. So that's a brief introduction to technical aspects of petroleum vapor intrusion. There's other things to worry about at specific sites, particularly dealing with neighbors in the community. There's a number of questions on this slide. Good questions that people ask when you're dealing with them at sites. I'm going to refer you to the appendix in the ITRC guide with a lot of good information and sheets in terms of how to deal with these types of questions when they come up on sites. Now, in terms of review, what I covered here is this conceptual site model for petroleum vapor intrusion, the various compartments, evidence for the petroleum biodegradation, and factors which affect oxygen in the subsurface. And with that, I believe, we're ready for the next section, and I'm going to pass this to Ian Herz.
Thank you very much, George. We're going to now move on to site screening. All right, we're on slide 43. And the outline for what we want to cover today is the conceptual site model. We're going to briefly touch on the rationale for the empirical basis for screening. So that was quite a comprehensive database study. We're going to go through the stepwise approach that's described in the ITRRC guidance, help you better understand how you can actually implement this framework at sites, and we're going to provide a brief case study example. So our objectives really are to provide you with a better understanding of the site screening and the basis for that and how to implement it, and again, to help you think through how could you apply this at sites that you're currently managing. So the site screening is a new method for evaluating petroleum vapor intrusion at sites. And it involves a vertical distance approach, and it requires identification of the minimum thickness of unimpacted soil needed to effectively biodegrade petroleum hydrocarbon vapors to low concentrations that are below a threshold of concern. And it's based on empirical data analysis as well as some modeling studies that were conducted by George DeWall and others that really came to the same conclusions as our empirical data analysis. And the reason why we think this is important is this approach is, I think, going to really improve our screening. It's going to identify those low-risk sites where we can effectively screen them out early in the process, and then I think help prioritize and focus our resources on those sites that are higher risk. So this slide here is the conceptual model of our vertical screening distances. This is a really important slide because it helps us understand the difference between an LNAPL source and a dissolved phase source. So let's go through that. We're going to start with LNAPL. We have LNAPL that could be mobile LNAPL and observed in wells, but could very well also be just residual LNAPL. So that could be in a smear zone, partly above the water table, partly below. And so particularly when it's exposed to LNAPL above the water table, we can have significant concentrations. Those vapors would move upward and oxygen would move down, and there would be that aerobic biodegradation interface that George spoke of. Because the concentrations can be relatively high, it may take some distance for attenuation and that aerobic biodegradation interface. In contrast, if we have a dissolved phase source, we have concentrations in groundwater. They would move up through a capillary a fringe transition zone, and there would be attenuation through that. And then at a certain point, there would be air-filled or gas-filled pores, which vapors would, or groundwater would partition into the vapor phase. And consequently, the concentrations are much lower. So studies where individuals have compared vapor concentrations above LNAPL and dissolved phase sources, often dissolved phase sources are 2 to 3 orders of magnitude lower concentrations. And consequently, that aerobic biodegradation interface is shown much closer to the source. So we find that it takes much less distance for vapors to degrade to low concentrations. So that's conceptually our framework and the way that we categorize sites. With respect to the vertical screening distances shown on the left side of the slide, that's the outcome of this evaluation that was conducted. And I'm going to get into the details, but there's 15 feet required for LNAPL sources from petroleum UST or AST sites, so those are small sites, smaller releases. 18 feet for sources associated with petroleum industrial sites, so there was less data for that category of sites, but slightly larger distance for sites with those larger releases. And then the last category there is 5 feet for dissolved phase sources. And so, again, that reflected the different source strength for dissolved phase source. So let's move on to the basis for the site screening. So This is actually work that I'm very familiar with. I worked for US EPA, developed a database, and we spent several years looking at that. I do want to first, though, just recognize Robin Davis, a regulator with the state of Utah, who really started this off quite a number of years ago by compiling site data from Utah and other states, and she did a very nice job of putting together a database, which then was subsequently sort of expanded upon, and we added new data, and we conducted some further filtering and quality control checks of the data. But really, Robin Davis was instrumental. So it's a large body of data collected between 1995 and 2011, and it's a compilation of paired measurements where we have concurrent source strength data on groundwater and then associated vapor data, quite a number of sites with vertical profiles of vapors, and data from hundreds of petroleum release sites. And they spanned a wide range of geographical locations and environmental and site conditions. And I'll speak to that a little bit more in the next slide. And the analysis showed a significant biodegradation attenuation of vapors vertically above sources within short predictable distances. A little bit more about the site types, mostly gasoline sites, but there are about half a dozen sites with diesel. Quite a number of those sites were inferred to have ethanol up to 10% in gasoline. 38 sites had vapor data below buildings. And so that was important because it gave us a basis for applying the screening distances to those sites where there could be potential concern about so-called oxygen shadow that might be caused by buildings. And we actually didn't find that to be a significant factor. And then we conducted the analysis for the three site and source types that I've already spoken about, the dissolve phase, and then the Alnapple for the smaller UST, AST sites, and then the larger petroleum industrial sites, the terminals and refineries. So now, with respect to the geographical distribution of sites, there were 74 sites, mostly in the U.S., a few in Canada. As you can see, that they span sort of a relatively wide geographical area. There were certainly sites in some areas of Utah and California where conditions were relatively dry, low soil moisture to wetter conditions. And so I think this sort of improved the confidence in the data that it could be applied nationwide. Another interesting development that occurred about the same time is that Jackie Wright in Australia, a consultant there, compiled data from about 124 sites with over 1,000 measurements and really came to similar conclusions with respect to the vertical screening distances. There are also a number of publications there that really are the key ones. In some respects, some of the data was similar, but there were also some additional or different data sets that were evaluated. And I think the important thing is that similar conclusions were drawn with respect to the screening distances. And the last document there, the EPA document, is the one that I worked on for several years. So now we're just moving on to a little bit more on the database, just to show the distributions, the types of chemicals for which we had soil gas data. I can see a broad range. Certainly, we had the most data for benzene, but we did have data for TPH fractions, the MADEP fractions, or the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, for aromatics and aliphatics. We had some of those other hydrocarbons that potentially are of concern, like hexane. And then we had data on the fixed gases, the oxygen, carbon dioxide, and methane. So a significant database was developed. Moving on to the empirical data analysis. So this was important with respect to trying to understand the attenuation. And shown there is a little schematic there of a ruler and Alnapple and dissolve phase source, and we see a biodegradation zone. And really what we're trying to do is understand the concentration attenuation relative to a threshold. We adopted a probability-based method. So what we did is we took that data and we essentially binned it with respect to varying distances. and then through a statistical method developed a understanding of the distance for which or required for attenuation to below a risk-based threshold. And the risk-based thresholds for benzene were at the start were 50 to 100 micrograms per meter cubed. There's been some further analysis that I'll show in a moment that actually looked at lower concentrations. We used an attenuation factor of 0.01 as I think is a reasonable attenuation between shallow soil vapor and indoor air. We actually had a lot of non-detect data, so it's a sort of a technical note on one aspect of the analysis, but we used, I think, quite a rigorous method involving a substitution method and then the Kaplan-Meier method, which is a robust non-parametric method. It's being used in survival analysis. It's also actually part of the US EPA Pro UCL statistics package, so it's become a pretty common way to deal with non-detects. So now let's move on to the actual results of this empirical data analysis. So I have four slides I'm going to show. I'll move through it fairly quickly. This first one is for dissolved phase sources, and it shows a relatively high concentrations with small distance between the soil vapor probe and contamination, but as the distance increases, you see that the concentrations rapidly decreased to less than 50 to 100 micrograms per meter cubed. The vertical screening distance was determined to be 5 feet. I'm not showing it today, but we conducted this analysis for many of those chemicals that I showed in the pie chart, and benzene was the driver with respect to requiring the greatest distance. This next slide here is the probability analysis that was conducted. And so what we're looking at is the probability of a vapor concentration less than a threshold. So if we have zero distance, a very small distance, that probability is a bit lower, but it's already over 90%, and that increases with increasing distance between the soil vapor probe and contamination. And it gave, I think, a high level of confidence that 5 foot screening distance was protective. So now on to the next slide. This is the LNAPL source from UST and AST sites. You'll note that the vapor concentrations, benzene vapor concentrations, are much higher. That's a log scale. And the distance required for those concentrations to decrease to below levels of concern was about 15 feet. With respect to the industrial sites, there was less data. I'm not showing that today, but that was about 18 feet. Again, benzene required the greatest distance to attenuate. This next slide here shows the conditional probability analyses and shows at small distances probability around 50 to 60% and increasing to over 90% at around 15 feet separation distance. Okay, so I mentioned that some further analysis was done for lower benzene concentrations, and this analysis was done by Dr. George Duvall, and it's actually documented in the appendix of the ITRC guidance. But what he did was look at varying soil gas screening levels and then recalculated the LNAPL screening distance and the dissolved phase screening distance and found that even at low benzene screening, soil gas screening levels, those distances would still apply. And so I think that was an important analysis to kind of further give us confidence with the screening approach that we came up with. So at this point, I'm now going to transition to using the site screening process. So this is a pretty simple flow chart. Step one is develop your CSM for site screening. Step two is to determine whether there are precluding factors present. If there are, then you should move to a more in-depth investigation for PVI, and Lauren will speak to that today. If not, then continue on and determine whether your current or future building is located within the lateral inclusion zone. We'll talk about that distance and how that was determined in subsequent slides. And if the answer is yes, then you would apply the vertical screening distance. So let's move through these steps. First of all, develop a conceptual site model, and there are a number of steps associated with that or factors that we should look at. First of all, I mean, this is a routine part of an investigation, and often it's helpful to think both of the risk assessment framework, where you look at sources and pathways and receptors, but also the fate and transport pathways, how chemicals behave in the subsurface, and we've shown here anaerobic biodegradation zone and biodegradation occurring such that there isn't vapors moving up into that building. But the things to look at are the site type, the source of the vapors, the extent of the source, some precluding factors, certain conditions where we should not apply this framework, how to come up with that lateral inclusion zone, and then finally the vertical separation distance. So if we now move through this to the first step, the site type, again, it's really important to understand whether we have the petroleum UST or the petroleum industrial sites. And one of the things that I think really affected our analysis is the typical volume magnitude of a spill that or release that would occur with these types of sites. And so if you're looking at, for example, a UST sites with a very large catastrophic release, that would perhaps affect your analysis, and you should consider maybe applying the larger distance or doing further investigation. So that's just, I think, one caution that you should be aware of. Next step is the petroleum vapor source. And a really important step is to determine whether we have an LMAPL or a dissolved phase source. And really, we recommend a multiple line of evidence approach consisting of direct indicators, such as product or in a well or sheens, or indirect indicators, such as concentrations in soil or groundwater. And important, again, to recognize that LMAPL sources include sites with free product as well as residual LMAPL. So it is important to have a robust conceptual site model and to use the types of tools that will help you determine whether you have a LMAPL or dissolved phase source. So we would suggest that you obtain soil cores, that you conduct screening with a PID, that possibly consider technologies like laser-induced fluorescence, ways to better determine whether you have an LMAPL source. There is also a very helpful table in the guidance, table 3.1, which we'll move to next. And that provides, again, kind of a list of things to look for, as well as some criteria that you could apply. So these are general indicators for PVI screening. Just again, a caution is that certainly you need to be aware of different types of LMAPL sources, gasoline versus diesel mixtures, and so some of these criteria, for example, for benzene and TPH may not necessarily hold, but these are, again, general indicators that you could apply at many sites. So, for example, benzene concentrations greater than about 1 to 5 milligrams per liter is a good indicator or line of evidence for the presence of LMAPL. I think a few others there that we can look at are some concentration-based thresholds. Benzene of 10 milligrams per liter or milligrams per kilogram or TPH of around 250 to 500. Again, it's a reasonable, I think, indicator based on the data that we reviewed for LMAPL sources. Let's continue on. The extent of the source is important to understand. Delineation is essential, and that should be done with respect to LMAPL. Understanding the top of the LMAPL, the smear zone, sources in your VADO zone. So again, we need sufficient frequency of field screening and lab analyses. With respect to the dissolved phase plume, the edge of the plume often is characterized using MCLs or possibly detection limits, and there may be state guidance that apply in the jurisdiction that you're working in. So That's important for our lateral inclusion zone. Next are precluding factors. There are a number of possible factors where you would not want to apply this vertical screening approach. First of all, preferential pathways. They can be natural. Karst geology would be one example, or highly fractured vertical or near vertical orientation of fracture sets. Those kinds of sites really require more in-depth site-specific investigation. Or anthropogenic, poorly sealed utility line. There is an example that's shown on a subsequent slide, which I'll speak to that particular precluding factor. Expanding or advancing plumes. If that's the case, then, again, you would not apply this guidance. And there's some excellent guidance on LNAPL remedial technologies that does speak to stability of LNAPL bodies, and actually that team is currently updating that guidance. Next are certain types of fuels. So there have been questions about lead scavengers, 1,2-DCA, dichloroethane, and ethylene dibromide. They were historically contained in leaded gasoline. There is research ongoing. I'm involved in, and several others, and we're trying to determine whether that's a significant issue. I think we're going to have some answers relatively soon. With respect to ethanol, quite a bit of work has been done, and the consensus is that certainly up to 10% ethanol is not a significant added concern, and that the screening can be applied to those sites. Now, if there is very high ethanol content, the concern is that it does degrade rapidly. It does produce methane, and that potentially could reduce the degradation of compounds like BTEX or possibly enhance soil gas ejection, which are conditions that which should be evaluated separately. So if you have, again, a very high ethanol content or perhaps a commingled plume, I mean, this would be quite rare, but that would be a consideration. Finally, soil types. We looked at this extensively in the database, and we really did not find sites that would be a concern. Conceptually, one could identify sites with very low soil moisture below the wilting point, perhaps in extreme climates, desert climates, that there could be concern about biodegradation. Precluding factors here are shown with respect to the fractured bedrock. So here we have fractures that extend very close to the foundation. That's a fairly obvious one. On the right-hand side is the preferential pathway associated with utility. Really what we're looking here is at our utilities, like sewers that connect contamination sources with buildings. And there could be an open floor drain, there could be just a direct pathway. Because we know that there's, in urban areas, there's many utilities, often they're not significant. So it's understanding the significance of that. There is ongoing work to better define utilities and potential vapor migration in sewers, for example. But I think one just needs to take a practical approach, understand your utilities at the site, and then really determine if it's like a direct connection between your contamination and the building airspace. The lateral inclusion zone is defined from the edge of the dissolved phase plume, and that's again often an MCL. And if you exceed 30 feet, then you're outside of that zone, and you do not need to, estimation, look at PVI. And then looking at the vertical separation distance, again, a reminder that it's for an LNAPL source to the top of the smear zone. With respect to a dissolved phase source, one does need to consider fluctuating water tables and seasonal differences, and so you really want to look at the high water table. And in some cases, I think it can be very helpful to install a pressure transducer or collect multiple rounds of water table elevation, so you better understand that variability. Step two is back in the flowchart, asks whether precluding factors are present. So we've gone over that from previous slides. If not, are we within the lateral inclusion zone? That's 30 feet. And then step three is we conduct the screening with the vertical separation distance. It gets 18 or 15 feet for USTs, 18 feet for industrial sites, and 5 feet for all dissolved phase sites. One aspect of this conceptual model I just wanted to point out to you is the upper figure on the right-hand side where we have a former UST and a perching or perched zone there with NAPL that's spread out. And that distance, Z, is to the top of that LNAPL zone. So it's not necessarily to the water table. So that's where your conceptual model is important. So again, we just want to point that out. Here's a real quick little case study data that was provided by Robin Davis. Develop your CSM. Step two is, are there precluding factors? There were none. The plume was stable or shrinking. There was no lead scavengers in up to or less than 10% ethanol. The buildings that were on the site were within the lateral inclusion distance. And so they were within 30 feet. Step three was to look at that vertical separation distance. And so based on high water table, it was about 7.7 feet. And consequently, for a dissolved phase source, that indicated sufficient separation. I should just note that there was a lines of evidence evaluation conducted to determine whether there was an LNAPL or dissolved phase source. The benzene concentration was just under 1 milligram per liter, so that would be indicative of likely a dissolved phase. It's near the threshold for where you might have an LNAPL source, but based on other lines of evidence, full cores and so forth, it was determined to be a dissolved phase source. And Utah DEQ determined the PVI pathway wasn't complete and no further analysis or testing was required. With that, we're going to move to participant questions and back to you, Juliana, to moderate that.
Thank you, Ian. Anyone is welcome to send in questions using the Q&A pod in the lower right. For our phone line participants, if you'd like to jump in and ask questions out loud, it's #6 to unmute. I'll also remind you at this point, before you leave today, we do ask that you complete the feedback form. And in the middle right, related URLs, the last item is feedback. You select feedback, look down a bit, select browse to. That's going to open the feedback form in a new window for you. We really do use your feedback and appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us feedback. It's also your path to be able to create a certificate of participation. So be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended, and the system's going to create a certificate for you if that's something that you can use. A few questions have come in already. For sites with water wells pumping near the petroleum plumes, would you discuss how to screen out sites with a range of pumping rates and under snow and ice conditions?
That's a really interesting question. I think there's maybe a couple parts to that. First, if I understood correctly, there's a pumping scenario. Could you repeat that part of the question, Juliana?
So it's for sites with water wells pumping near the petroleum plumes. And so how do you just screen out the sites with a range of pumping rates?
Pumping rates, yeah. That's a condition that I'm thinking is not really addressed in the database analyses and sites that we looked at. So it's a kind of a special case, and I think one would want to really understand how the pumping affects the LNAPL body and if the LNAPL is stable. I think some of the principles, really what we're discussing today, would still apply, but I think I would be cautious with that and with respect to screening out of sites where there is pumping. With respect to the second part of the question, the ice and snow conditions, not directly addressed in this presentation, but I've done work on cold climate vapor intrusion. We've looked at sites where there has been snow cover and ice, relatively cold conditions, and we found no significant evidence of concern with respect to, you know, significantly reduced attenuation. Biodegradation did occur. There have been a number of studies that show that the rates, they are possibly slightly less than you'd expect in more temperate climates, but still quite significant. So the short answer is I think the guidance can be applied to sites where, there's some winter conditions, snow and ice.
Just curious, any empirical data to suggest lateral separation might be closer to 5 feet instead of 30 feet at dissolved impacted sites?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's really a similar number, we think, or a distance for lateral and vertical attenuation. One could envision possibly where there's a capping effect and perhaps some enhanced lateral migration, but I think that generally would not be significant. And consequently, in the question really is an appropriate one, but it really I think comes down to a more practical, pragmatic approach that we followed with respect to the typical kind of spacing and site characterization that is performed and the uncertainty in that. And so I think the fallback was to go to 30 feet, which we'd have some confidence in that we wouldn't necessarily underestimate or just based on the uncertainty in site characterization.
Does your research include evaluation of additives, for example, static dispenser additives, fuel system, icing inhibitors, metal deactivators, antioxidants, gum inhibitors?
Okay. There is research ongoing on lead scavengers, so the chlorinated compounds. The database did include consideration of MTBE. That was... there are a few sites with significantly elevated MTBE vapor concentrations near an LNAPL source, but we also saw evidence for attenuation. And based on the available data, that was determined not to be a driver. So benzene was the driver for the range of compounds that we looked at. With respect to some of the other additives and metals and things like that, I don't think those were looked at, but I'm not sure that they would be of significant concern with respect to the vapor intrusion.
How does the physical properties of the soil affect the gas mobility?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question, and certainly does affect transport with respect to diffusion, and certainly we might expect to see somewhat different behavior with respect to, for example, coarse versus fine-grained soils. The database did include a range of soil types, so from fine-grained to coarse-grained, and we did not see a significant difference in the attenuation distance. So I think we don't see a particular concern with respect to the outcome of the screening, but certainly it can affect transport of vapors.
Our next question applies to slide 31. I'm going to jump back here in a second. Regarding the volatility versus petroleum vapor intrusion potential charted on slide 31, where does heating oil plot compare to diesel? Is volatility and PVI potential heating oil the same as diesel, higher or lower?
Well, heating oil, I think, often is a fuel oil number two, if that's the type of oil that's used, for example, for residential buildings, smaller buildings. So perhaps there are heavier end oils used for large boilers and, bunker C type. But as we're speaking about number two fuel oil, that's very similar to diesel. And if we are referring to, and I'm just flipping back to slide 31, so I have it in front of me now. If we're referring to heavier end oils, they would fall to the right of the diesel fuel curve there.
For a site in fractured bedrock, groundwater at 60 feet, what would a safe vertical distance to use?
60 feet. I think that if we go back to the principles that George spoke of and how biodegradation does readily occur, we would expect to see attenuation probably within that 60 feet. It's just be hard to imagine where that would not occur, but. I think that's kind of a site-specific evaluation, and there may be considerations for advection. I mean, the concern with fractures that are vertical or near vertically oriented and is that you just have much more rapid movement of vapors through those than you would have through porous media. So, of course, it really depends on the fracture, type of fractures you have, bedrock, and so I think that's, that needs a kind of a site-specific evaluation.
Would you discuss screening out of diving plumes and vertical migration of petroleum BTEX and MTB under fresh zones?
The data that we collected, I think a lot of sites are sources or dissolved plumes that are near sources where the highest concentrations are at the water table. So there were a few sites where such data was collected. There was a geoprobe where there were vertical profiles not only of vapors but of groundwater. The diving plumes, I certainly have seen that at sites I've looked at in some cases, so moving away from a source, but I don't think that had any effect really on the analyses. I think what I'm really trying to say is that I think we looked at sources where concentrations were high near the water table and that, in a conservative kind of type of analysis.
In desert conditions, for example, Mojave Desert around Las Vegas, does the very low organic content in the soil significantly reduce the aerobic degradation?
Well, I mentioned that based on the database sites, we didn't see evidence for that effect or either very low organic carbon or moisture. There are some bioventing studies, quite a large number of sites that were investigated by the US EPA, Air Force bases, that included a site just outside of Palm Springs, which was very dry and where there was some evidence for decreased biodegradation rates in that, but still biodegradation was occurring. So that's probably the most extreme example I can think of. Those kinds of sites would perhaps require some further evaluation, be it maybe soil gas profiles or better understanding of soil moisture and organic carbon.
Thank you. We're out of questions right now, so we'll go ahead on with the second half of the training. Throughout the training class, you're welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right, and we'll try to get to those during the next question and answer break, or we'll answer those online. I'll also remind you, if you do leave before we wrap up, please fill out the feedback form. It's available through the middle right, related URLs, fourth item down. Select the feedback, then select Browse To. That's going to allow that feedback form to open. We'll now continue on with the next section in today's training, and I'm going to turn it over to Lauren Lund at CH2M Hill. Lauren?
Thank you, Juliana. So the section I'm going to talk about is investigation. And we are now on slide number 70. So chapter 4 of the document, it's titled Site Investigations, and it does describe a five-step process for investigating petroleum VI. And that's for sites where the site screening that Ian just talked about did not eliminate PVI from further consideration. Some of the reasons for not screening out do include insufficient separation distance, from precluding factors or regulatory-specific requirements. Multiple lines of evidence are needed during a site investigation. The five-step process that we've outlined in Chapter 4, particularly in the decision flowchart, it really is based on a multiple lines of evidence approach. It is up to the investigator to go ahead and collect and understand the different types of data and the information that you do need. It is important, though, to focus the investigation only on the data and the lines of evidence needed to assess petroleum VI. So site investigation, it starts with step 4, and that's a concentration-based evaluation using your existing data. If the PVI pathway is not eliminated, step 5 then involves selecting the applicable conceptual site model scenario and then the corresponding sampling approach. The data are then evaluated in step 6, and since PVI is an iterative process, you as the investigator determine in step 7 whether additional investigation is warranted. And then finally, the last step involves determining if the PVI pathway is complete. These steps are outlined in Figure 4.1, 4-1, and it's a little small on your screen, but remember you can download that figure. One last comment, remember that the decision to implement vapor controls in lieu of further site investigation can be made at any time in the process. So we're on slide number 73 now. This slide, I think, let me try that again. Yeah, I'm sorry. I messed it up for you. I was supposed to advance each of these steps, so let me get to slide 73. Okay, here we are, slide 73. So this slide summarizes step 4, and that's where you're comparing existing concentrations with screening levels. These screening levels, they do vary by state and region, so it is important to check with your local regulatory agency for the applicable screening levels. You can also refer to the ITRC Spring 2012 Petroleum VI State Survey, and we've summarized that in Appendix A of the guidance. So comparing with screening values, it can help you to determine if additional investigation is necessary. I do want to point out, though, that this concentration-based screening step, it is independent of the vertical screening distance method that Ian just described in Chapter 3. So step 5 involves selecting the scenario that best fits your site, along with designing the investigative approach. So your site should fit under either Scenario 1, where contamination is not in contact with the building, or Scenario 2, where you've got contamination in contact with the building. Now, there are a few other scenarios that I will discuss or mention. The types of the investigation strategies really depends on the scenario that's specific to your site. Regulatory agencies, they often do have requirements or guidance that's specific to investigating the vapor intrusion pathway, or they may rely solely on EPA's guidance. So understanding these applicable regulatory requirements, it's really an important part of designing a successful investigation. So let's start with Scenario 1 under Step 5, where your contamination is not in contact with the building. We would expect that the initial investigation approach here will most likely be some additional soil gas sampling, since soil gas data are reflective of the fate and transport processes that do occur in the VADO zone between the contamination source and your overlying building. And these include things like partitioning, sorption, and biodegradation. Now, there are some alternative approaches that we mention here, and those could include collecting groundwater, soil, subslab soil gas, or indoor and outdoor air data. For scenario number 2, where you have contamination that's in direct contact with the building, it may not be possible to collect some subslab soil gas samples due to soil saturation. Therefore, we really would expect that the initial investigation approach would most likely be indoor air or crawl space sampling, along with concurrent outdoor air sampling. There are some alternative approaches. They're less common, but you might be able to collect samples within the slab or use flux chambers. You could also collect some sump water samples or the headspace vapor samples if those sumps are present. However, I have found that interpreting these data can be technically challenging. So make sure you get consensus with your regulators and your stakeholders on how the data that you're proposing under these alternative approaches would be interpreted. So we're now on slide number 77, and this slide shows the investigative options for the other scenarios that are listed on figure 4-1. For a site where you've got intermittent petroleum odors, and assuming that this is not an emergency situation, your initial investigation approach would most likely be a building walkthrough, followed by some indoor air sampling to verify the presence of the petroleum hydrocarbons. If you do verify the presence of those hydrocarbons, that would lead to a more detailed investigation. For undeveloped lots, the groundwater, soil, or the soil gas methods that I discussed for scenario one would apply, and that's because structure sampling is not possible. If there are significant preferential pathways or you do suspect them, the initial investigation approach would most likely be indoor air sampling. However, alternatives for these potentially significant preferential pathways may include vapor sampling within the utility bedding or the actual cavity of the utility, soil permeability testing, and direct utility conduit air sampling. We do have methods that are described in the IHRC 2007 vapor intrusion guidance for commingled contaminated sites that fall under the category of others. So I did want to take a moment on this slide here just to remind folks about the toolbox that we've included in Appendix G of the guidance. It really is a tremendous resource. It provides many more details on the site investigation methods than what we could include in Chapter 4. And it does answer many of the what, how, and the why questions. It also includes some videos, some step-by-step instructions, list of analytical methods, and much more. I highly recommend you or your contractors take the time to review this appendix, especially during your work planning stage. So we're now moving on to step 6, slide number 79. This is the data evaluation step where the completeness and the significance of the pathway are assessed. So make sure you consider data quality such as detection limits and sampling errors. The multiple lines of evidence evaluation steps that I'm showing here, they are described in detail in the 2007 IHRC vapor intrusion guidance. They do include things such as comparing your concentrations with screening levels. Those screening levels may be based on default assumptions, empirical data, or even modeled attenuation. It is important to determine whether the published values that you're considering using have accounted for bioattenuation and whether the site-specific attenuation factors should be calculated. And the reason for thinking about this is many sites, we do find that PVI is not an issue if bioattenuation has been properly accounted for. So make sure you're looking at the basis for your screening levels. Also, remember to account for the potential biases from background sources when you're evaluating your indoor air data. As many of you know, there are common petroleum hydrocarbons that are used in commercial products. Lastly, make sure you consider both the individual and the cumulative lines of evidence when you're evaluating the data. So step 7 then reflects the iterative nature of the investigation process when you're determining whether the site's been adequately characterized and whether you need additional investigation. Some other questions that you'll want to think about during this step is whether the site contaminants really have been properly delineated, whether PVI has been assessed at all of the potentially affected buildings, and whether there are sufficient data to reach a vapor control decision at the site. If you do conclude that you do still have some data gaps, it may be necessary to collect some additional data using the methods that I just described, or you could, as I mentioned earlier, refer to Appendix G for some additional tools. And that includes things like evaluating building construction, HVAC operation, and also vapor flux. Okay, we're on step 8, slide 81. Once you have determined that sufficient data have been collected, the final step in the site investigation process is to determine the completeness of the pathway. If the pathway is incomplete, then you can conclude no further evaluation is necessary. But if the pathway is complete with the potential for unacceptable risks, then you really should consider implementing the vapor control approaches that are described in Chapter 6. So the last few slides that I'm going to cover here is a case study. And this site is a gasoline diesel site in Salina, Utah. Groundwater is at 20 feet with a silty sand and fine-grained sand lithology in the Vedo Sun. The petroleum hydrocarbon releases were from dispensers, product lines, and USTs. So let's start with steps 1, 2, and 3 and that from Chapter 3, and they involve developing a preliminary conceptual site model, determining that there were no precluding factors and the building was within 30 feet laterally from the dissolved and LNAPL sources, and then ultimately concluding that PVI could not be eliminated as a possibility, because if you look at this picture, you can see that the LNAPL was only 5 feet below the slab with insufficient vertical separation distance. Therefore, further investigation was warranted. So a concentration-based evaluation, which is step 4, it did indicate that the benzene near slab soil gas levels, shown here in this call-out box, they did exceed the EPA vapor intrusion screening level by multiple orders of magnitude. Therefore, it was necessary to proceed to step 5 in the site investigation process. So we're now on slide number 85. And remember, you need to determine which scenario your site falls in. And as you can see on this slide circled in red, this site, the groundwater was not in contact with the building. The concurrent subslab soil gas, indoor air, and outdoor air sampling was selected by the Utah DEQ as the investigative strategy. Sampling was conducted during two separate seasons or events. Now, although step 6, or the data evaluation step, so we're on slide 87, determined that the indoor air and outdoor air non-detect concentrations were greater than a 10 to minus 6 target risk level, both the detected and the non-detected indoor air concentrations were similar to the 10 to the minus 5 based vapor intrusion screening level that's used by Utah DEQ. Staff at Utah DEQ also noted that the indoor and the outdoor air concentrations were likely similar, suggesting the possibility of a background outdoor air source. I found at sites like these that the subslab concentrations that are listed here, they really do represent a very low source strength, particularly given the amount of bioattenuation that we would expect. So it was concluded then during step 7 here that additional investigation was not warranted. During step 8, it was concluded that the PVI pathway was not complete, and that's because indoor air concentrations were similar to the applicable risk-based screening levels. They were non-detect, or they were similar to outdoor air concentrations. So as you could look at this figure and think back to the vapor samples right outside the building, and also, you know, when you consider the proximity of the LNAPL, the vapors really have significantly bioattenuated from this relatively shallow NAPL source. And the indoor air concentrations are likely due to the background levels or sources. This slide is a reminder to you that it is important to engage stakeholders throughout the investigation process. And I do list some of the likely questions that building occupants and other stakeholders will ask during your PVI investigations. You'll find that things will go much more smoothly if you're proactive and you field and answer these questions early. You can refer to Chapter 7 for more details on community engagement. So the final slide here in my section is a summary slide, just a reminder that you need to know the applicable regulatory requirements, take a multiple lines of evidence approach, apply that five-step process that's outlined in the decision flow chart. Don't forget to consider or use the toolbox in Appendix G, and it'll provide you, it's a guide to the expected of and also alternative investigation methods. And then lastly, don't forget to communicate with your stakeholders. So that completes my section. I'm going to turn it back over to Ian Hers from Golder Associates.
Thanks very much, Lauren. We're going to now move on to modeling, and we're on slide 92. This is a short section that is intended to provide an overview of information on the modeling process. We're going to describe the BioVapor model, which we think is an appropriate model for screening, and we're going to describe some of the key features associated with that model and then provide a case study where that model was used. And so our learning objectives today are to first determine if modeling is applicable for evaluating petroleum vapor intrusion at your site, understand a little bit about the BioVapor model, and ask appropriate questions about model inputs and results. And really, our objective here is not to provide an in-depth modeling presentation, but just to touch on some highlights and hopefully help you if you are reviewing or conducting a modeling assessment, and just to begin to ask some of the questions that are needed. Just also refer you to some great work resources in Chapter 5 and Appendix H and I of the guidance, which has much more information on modeling. So let's move on to, first of all, why use models to evaluate PVI? Well, first of all, you may want to predict health risk when you fail the screening process. And so models can be used, and it may depend on your local jurisdiction that you work in and with respect to how they're used and validated. Secondly, you may drive cleanup goals for groundwater or for soil vapor based on acceptable risk, and that can be helpful in the site management process, can help prioritize areas of potential concern and where you would initially want to remediate to address vapor intrusion risk. Thirdly, they can be used to help with the conceptual site model to understand the key factors affecting biodegradation, to conduct what-if analyses. They can also be used to support remedial design, and if that design is utilizing oxygen to degrade petroleum vapors, so that's kind of an emerging possibility with respect to mitigation, and so a model could be used to help guide that process. And then finally, they are used to support vertical screening distances. Well, there's three model types that can be used to evaluate PVI, and we think the first one is really empirical data. It is a model. It's a way of using data to come up with, for example, a vertical exclusion distance, or in some cases, bioattenuation factors have been applied to factors that are based on non-degrading compounds. Secondly, analytical models are certainly have been used. For example, the Johnson and Ettinger model has for the last two decades or so been used to derive generic attenuation factors or criteria in various jurisdictions. Really, for our purposes, though, for petroleum vapors, we want to use a model that incorporates aerobic biodegradation, and that's what BioVapor is for. And then finally, numerical models. In some cases, for more complex sites where you would like maybe more realistic representation of fate and transport, perhaps looking at multidimensional transport, then these tools are available and have been used. But I would say their use is infrequent and really being largely focused on research type projects. And just to note that the level of effort and type of data that's needed is relatively large for such models. So the acceptability of models is an important question, and I think that's an emerging kind of issue, so to speak. There was a survey that was conducted on behalf of Massachusetts DEP in 2010 where the company that did the survey went to various state agencies and asked them about the use of models. And they found that at that time, 11 states' models could be used as the sole basis for eliminating consideration of the VI pathway. In seven others, it could be a line of evidence to support other data, and then in eight states, there was specific reference to confirmatory sampling required. And so this is, again, an emerging area, model use, and so we just recommend that you are aware of the requirements in your local jurisdiction that you're working in. The next slide, slide 96, is the framework for using models for a petroleum vapor intrusion modeling assessment. And I think these principles apply to really any type of modeling study. But you first define the problem and your objectives. What do you really intend to use the model for? Secondly, review your conceptual site model. And select a model that's consistent, or a mathematical model that's consistent with the CSM. And for example, if you have fractured bedrock or preferential pathways or conditions that are outside of that, the model that you're using, of course, you would not want to use a model. Next is determine your model inputs. And there is, for the BioVapor model, I'm going to touch on that in subsequent slides, some excellent database and resources available for that. The next step is to compare your model predictions to available data. We deliberately did not use the word calibration. We think that for vapor intrusion modeling, you may have some subsurface vapor data, perhaps indoor air data, which you would want to be cautious with because of the potential for background. But it really is, I think, more of an order of magnitude type evaluation. And so I think calibration is it would be really beyond kind of the typical scope that we could achieve in a PVI modeling assessment. And then finally, what can be done is to conduct a sensitivity analysis. I think every study should have some analyses on the key factors and how they affect the results. This is an overview of the BioVapor model. It's available through the American Petroleum Institute. It was actually developed by Dr. George Duvall. And it is a model that incorporates aerobic biodegradation. It's relatively easy to use and has a built-in parameter database. It's actually also being reviewed and accepted by EPA, and it's the basis for their model that I believe is either come out or imminent with respect to release. It's called PVI Screen, and it incorporates the same principles, but I believe will include a probabilistic component such that you can put in ranges of input parameters. The model characteristics, it's the same conceptual framework and potential limitations as the Johnson and Energy model that includes aerobic bio. The key inputs are the oxygen boundary conditions. We'll touch on that in the next slide. The first order decay constant, which the database includes rates for all, I think, key petroleum constituents. And then a baseline respiration rate that's associated with natural organic carbon, which in some cases can be important. And then finally, source concentrations are also very important for biodegradation modeling with respect to potential oxygen limitation. So if you have a shallow source and very high concentrations, that's where you could predict limited attenuation. So let's think about the oxygen. There are three conditions that one could specify. First, you if you have, for example, a crawl space, you could specify the oxygen concentration below the foundation at atmospheric or near atmospheric concentrations, or you can measure it. Secondly, you could let the model balance the hydrocarbon flux and the oxygen consumption. And really, what we're doing here is we're specifying an airflow rate that occurs to below the foundation as a result of soil gas advection into the building. And because that advecting soil gas contains oxygen, it can be used for degradation below the building. I think it's a kind of a novel approach that was part of the formulation of the BioVapor model, and so there's a lot more information in the user's guide on that. And then the third is a specification of the aerobic depth. Again, if you had a vapor profile, you could specify that. So you can pick one method, and the others are related and predicted in a consistent way. I think it's a relatively novel and unique approach, particularly step four, method two. Next, I just wanted to talk about source concentrations. I mentioned that this is very important. Important to recognize that vapors are primarily all phthalic hydrocarbons. If you look, for example, at gasoline, aromatics represent typically a small percentage, less than 10%. Now, maybe a little bit different for diesel. But BioVapor allows you to input the full petroleum vapor composition. There's a good database, and you can also, of course, input site-specific information. So we encourage you to collect site-specific data, to analyze vapor samples for TPH, for the aromatic and aliphatic fractions, plus some of the key individual components, and then also to look at methane or analyze your samples for methane. So it's important to really represent the total composition with respect to oxygen demand, including methane. We're just going to end with just a brief case studies just to demonstrate how the BioVapor model has been used. So these are sites that I was provided data on or worked on. So one was in Salt Lake City, a dissolved source. We have the BioVapor prediction as the solid line there, red for benzene, blue for oxygen, and the dashed line is the J&E prediction without biodegradation. A little bit on the site. It was a shallow dissolved source. The separation between the building and source was about 4 feet. And source concentrations were quite high, but based on the available data, it was determined or assessed to be most likely a dissolved site. The measured subslab concentrations were less than that predicted by the model. So that means the model is conservative. The little table there shows the actual results. The modeling here was an added line of evidence for limited or no concern with respect to indoor air. And so here's where modeling, perhaps together with some indoor air testing, could be used to more confidently characterize the vapor intrusion pathway. The next case study is a site, Stafford, New Jersey, that I worked on, an interesting site with, actually we had pretty high concentrations below building. Separation distance was quite small, about 5 feet. You can see the source vapor concentrations there were quite high for benzene and TPH. We modeled isooctane and benzene, again, the dashed lines are the predictions without degradation. We found that, again, the measured indoor air and subslab were less than predicted. The model was conservative based on sort of the best estimates of input parameters. And really here, the modeling was an added line of evidence for evaluating potential background influences in indoor air and helping us to understand the relative behavior of aromatics and aliphatics. So you can see that the isooctane degradation, the concentrations actually to start with were higher and degradation was less. We actually found a complete pathway for that compound to indoor air, but not for benzene. So the benzene actually had degraded by the time it was in the subslab region. So again, just a quick modeling study to show how you could better understand your site conditions in those particular cases when perhaps you have shallow contamination, higher concentrations, more added complexity that you wish to understand. So with that, a quick summary. First of all, determine if modeling is applicable for evaluating petroleum vapor intrusion at your sites and identify the appropriate models. And I think BioVapor is a good model to use for screening purposes. And then ask appropriate questions about your model inputs and results. So with that, you're going to pass it off to Dave Folks.
Great. Thanks very much, Ian, and hello, everyone. Well, as we know by now, biodegradation minimizes the potential for petroleum vapor intrusion. But in my experience, and I'm sure many of yours, excuse me, sometimes sources can be shallow enough and strong enough that we do need to do something about it. We'll talk about how we do that. One of the main focuses of my discussion is going to be on how PVI is different from a mitigation standpoint from chlorinated solvents and how those differences affect your remedy decisions. I'll also use some examples, site examples to talk about different strategies or approaches we can take. And of course, I'll talk about where you can find this information in the guidance. Okay, so what is unique to PVI mitigation? What makes it a little different from chlorinated solvents, which many of you are probably used to? Well, first of all, petroleum contamination is usually a little easier to clean up than chlorinated solvents, and that means that sometimes source remediation itself may actually be our best approach to controlling vapors. And you can't always say that about chlorinated solvents. And in addition, we know that vertical distance between sources and our building affect how much bioattenuation we get. So at least with new construction, that may be something that we can use to our advantage. And also getting more oxygen under the building as well. So there's so things we can do to enhance biodegradation with PVI that aren't going to be as important or at all for chlorinated solvents. And then of course on the other side of the coin, of course, PVI is a little different because of the potential for explosion at high concentrations. You won't see that too often, but you need to make sure it's not happening. So before we dive into some examples, let's just take a step back and talk about vapor control strategies in general. And one question is, why use the term vapor control strategies instead of mitigation like we usually do? And the answer is that particularly for petroleum, we have a lot more than just mitigation at our disposal for dealing with vapor control. As I mentioned before, cleanup of the source itself may be your best option, or institutional controls, as many of you are familiar with. And mitigation is just, which we typically mean by that, building mitigation or radon systems, is just one of the tools that we have. In general, I find, and I expect most of you would find, that you tend to use at least a couple of these different approaches on most sites. Okay, so with that very brief primer, let's jump into some examples. In this case, it's pretty simple, but probably something many of you have run into. We've got a UST that's contaminated soils around it, but not the groundwater. We've got soil vapor above screening levels below our building next door, and indoor air levels above residential and below commercial screening levels. So that's the situation. And Juliana, if you wouldn't mind bringing up the polling questions. So what I have on the right side of the slide and what you have down below, and you might have to scroll down a bit to get them all, are the different approaches or tools that we could apply to this situation. And what I'd like you to do is to pick not just one, but even two or three things, if you think they're applicable, that you would most likely rely on to control vapors at a site like this. And, of course, we have remediation, mitigation and institutional controls is our three main approaches with some specific examples below. And emergency evacuation I've added in there is just something I'd like you to think about every time you walk up to a site like this. So we can see there's looks like our remediation team is leading with either excavation or soil vapor extraction, and that seems reasonable. And a little bit of mitigation and ICs bringing up the rear. If you wouldn't mind closing that, Juliana. Yeah, that's all the time you get to your cleanup. This slide just shows what the ITRC team thinks. You can compare it to what your thoughts were. Certainly a situation like this is not an emergency that would require evacuation of a building. Remediation does make a lot of sense, whether it's excavation or SVE, because you can probably do both fairly quickly. And mitigation is probably not warranted in our view because of that, building mitigation. But the other thing that not many people pick, but I think is certainly worth considering in a case like this, are institutional controls. If this is a commercial building, for example, then simply restricting residential use might be all you need to do while you take your time cleaning up the site. Okay, so let's go to another example, and this is a little more severe contamination where the LNAPL is gotten to the groundwater and floated under our building. The indoor air picture is still the same. We're above residential but below commercial screening levels, but we got a bigger mess on our hands. So, Juliana, if you would bring up the poll, and we'll try to clean up this site. So a little different situation. Obviously, you are going to have to do some remediation, but the question is, what's going to be your vapor control strategy? Are you going to rely on remediation, or are you going to rely on other things primarily? And we're kind of going back and forth on a few things. Got a little more mitigation. The remediation crew is still a little stronger here, and not many ICs. Okay, I think we're asymptoting here with our survey. So Juliana, if you would close that. And here's what the ITRC team thinks. In this case, we do expect that there would be remediation, but we don't think that you would be able to clean up the LNAPL below the building quickly enough to really address vapor intrusion in a timely manner, so that we think that mitigation would be the best option in this case for controlling vapors. But that ICs may very well be an optional strategy. So a lot of you picked remediation, and it may be because you're just thinking that that's something you're going to have to do anyways. But from a vapor mitigation standpoint, in these situations, you're probably going to have to look at mitigation or building controls, at least for a while. All right, just this is our last example, and this is the same condition as before, but now we don't have any buildings yet. We're it's a brownfield site. We're expecting to construct some buildings in the near future. And the question is what we do now as far as vapor intrusion goes. So, Juliana? One last chance for playing our cleanup game here, and in this case, you have a lot of options because you don't have a building yet. And I think that's being reflected in our survey here, where some people want to try and clean this up first. Not too many are looking at mitigation, maybe because there's not a building there yet, although there could be, and a little more ICs. Okay, that's interesting. Okay, Juliana, if you want to close that. And one more time, we'll go to the ITRC suggestion. And similar to a lot of you, we think that remediation certainly something that you might want to do while you can get at it without buildings in the way. And as I indicated earlier on in this section, maybe there's a potential with grading to create a bioattenuation zone, depending on the nature of the contamination. Mitigation is maybe something you want to plan for in the new construction. Just preemptively install mitigation systems, because it's a lot easier when you're building things than afterwards. Or once again, if this is a commercial development, you may not even have an issue if you can control it with institutional controls. So as you can see, a lot of different ways to skin the cat, and which approach you take is going to depend on the situation. So just diving back towards the guidance again, Chapter 6 is where we talk about these things. I've covered a lot of different concepts. I doubt you will remember them all, so I'd go back and take a look at Chapter 6. Appendix J is a really valuable chapter with a lot of information on different control methods. And for those of you who are familiar with the 2007 ITRC guidance and its similar appendix, this is actually an updated version. It applies as to chlorinated solvents or any other kind of VI mitigation. So just because it's in the PVI guidance, I'd certainly still recommend you take a look at it for chlorinated solvent issues. Then, just chat a little bit about community engagement. If anyone's going to have to deal with the building owners or occupants, it's going to be the people going out dealing with mitigation. So you really want to make sure that your people are trained, that you've looked at the fact sheets or have your own frequently asked question fact sheets, such as an Appendix K of the guidance, and are able to either answer the common types of questions listed here, or your people know who to refer the building occupants to, so because they're going to want to know these things. So, to summarize, if you don't remember anything else, I'd like you to remember that petroleum vapor intrusion mitigation is a little different than chlorinated solvent mitigation, which you may or may not be already familiar with. You generally have more options available because of the bioattenuation factor. You may be able to combine soil vapor extraction, for example, with mitigation of the building. But you also have to consider the explosive potential and make sure that's not an issue before you go any further. And more than anything else, just think outside the box. Don't just do the same thing you've always done because you think that's what you have to do. So, as Juliana mentioned, I'm earlier on, I'm going to just wrap things up for us with a few final slides here. So after this training today, you should hopefully know how to use our guidance. We don't expect you to remember everything that's been said, but now you know where to go and refresh yourself. You should also have a pretty good idea that biodegradation is the key for the PVI pathway and what really controls whether or not we have an issue. As always, even whether it's chlorinated or PVI, having a good conceptual site model is critical to understanding what needs to be done, whether you need to do anything. And the eight-step decision process that was described today with the flow charts is a nice systematic way for you to go through the process. As the little green or big green arrows to the side show, we expect that this will end up in most PV sites, most PVI sites screening out, but some are going to require you to go on to more detailed site investigations, and in a few cases you may have to do some vapor control and site management. This map, kind of interesting, it shows the states in blue that are using or planning to use the PVI, ITRC's PVI guidance in their own guidance, or at least referencing it, and little green book things are those that are already doing so. I'm not sure what Arkansas is doing, but hopefully they'll become blue in the near future as well. And one last thing before I turn it over to Juliana. We do have classroom training, which goes into much more detail than we could on this webinar, of course. And not only do we talk about the PVI guidance, but also EPA's guidance, which has a lot of similarities and some additional things, and just helps you bring those two together into your practice. Right now we have, we're planning two classes for next fall. There's an email address for you to find out when those will occur. We had several last year, and I think the year before, so I'm not sure how much longer these will go on. This may be getting close to your last chance to take advantage of these great classes. So, Juliana, I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks, Dave. We're going to wrap up today. We have about 15 minutes left for questions, so you're welcome to start sending in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. For additional resources, we have our links page. We've gathered together several things we've talked about today. You can download the PowerPoint presentation that you've seen during today's class. There's a link to the guidance document that's the basis of today's training, as well as other links available on that page. And it's going to continue to be available for you as a resource. We also have a link to our feedback form. We do ask that everyone fill out the feedback. We really do use the information that you provide. If you would like to create a certificate of participation for yourself, you can do that through the feedback form. So fill out the feedback form. Check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended today. Once you submit that feedback, there will be the similar icon, View Your Participation Certificate, that's going to allow you to get a PDF of your certificate for today's class. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit. That's going to allow the system to create that certificate for you. If you have more than one person at your location, you can have the first person fill out the feedback, submit, and then there's a link. You can go back and have the next person fill out the feedback and submit. So each person at your location can get a certificate from today's class. We'll now get to as many questions as we can that have come in so far. Would you discuss the potential for PVI to pick up other contaminants of concern like chlordane? And Ian, if you're answering, you do need to unmute so that we can hear you.
Juliana, sorry, could you repeat that, please?
Would you discuss the potential for PVI to pick up other contaminants of concern, like chlordane?
chlordane. Not sure I completely understand the context of that question, so perhaps the other facilitators on the training might be able to help, but it's not something that really has come up in my practice. Certainly one needs to be very careful with background, and there are a number of things that you'll certainly measure in indoor air that could affect, you know, your results. But any thoughts there, Dave or Lauren?
Well, I would just add that it's not uncommon to see both chlorinated solvents and petroleum at the same site due to multiple sources. And in those cases, although you have to deal with everything, the chlorinateds tend to drive a lot of your decision-making.
I would just add, and also like you, Ian, I'm not real clear about the specific example chemical that was highlighted in chlordane, but certainly there are a range of different volatilities associated with VOCs in this specific analytical technique that you're using, of course, has the potential to pick up a variety of different VOC or sufficiently volatile chemicals. So, you know, one of the things that we recommend anytime you go into a further site-specific investigation is to do your best to trim or limit your target analyte list to those that you know are likely to be site-related.
During the modeling section, you mentioned input take full composition. When calculating modeling results for each compound, does the model consider the migration velocity of the other components, considering both the adventive and the diffusional flow components?
The full composition is important so that one doesn't miss potential VI concern, and then also that we don't underestimate the oxygen demand. The model is a diffusion model for subsurface transport and aerobic biodegradation and advection and diffusion through the building foundation. So I'm not sure exactly what's being referred to, the advective component. That generally is not a significant concern unless there are really high methane concentrations. And, you know, in those cases, one could have advection. So certainly when you're beyond the lower explosive limit and or if you have site settings such as any, you know, municipal solid waste or similar type organics that are rapidly producing methane, and if those are associated with petroleum hydrocarbon or somehow they coexist, then that's where you'd be concerned, and the model does not address that.
Do the screening distances account for extreme contrast between indoor and outdoor temperature and air pressure? Are there upper and lower bounds to the applicability of screening distance with respect to these contrasts?
Well, first of all, temperature is something that can drive the stack effect. Certainly warm air inside buildings and cold outdoor temperatures, that's when you'd see the greatest stack effect. But really, I think that the science and the data that's available suggests that the attenuation factors and the vertical exclusion distances would apply to the vast majority of sites. So just thinking about that question, I don't think that that's a precluding or, you know, significant issue, pressure differences from temperature. Maybe that the second part of the question is kind of related to temperature produces pressure, and there may be other factors that cause significant pressure differences in buildings. certainly higher, you know, taller buildings, a greater stack effect. But again, I don't think that that's warrants particularly, you know, a different approach. So I'm not, if there's anything more there that maybe the person asking the question is kind of inferring, that would be good to know.
Can you please list preferable available engineering controls for PVI?
Well, that's a pretty involved question. Usually when I use the term engineering controls, I'm talking about actual building mitigation. And there are quite a number of different approaches you can use. And generally, they're exactly the same as you would use for any other form of vapor intrusion, like chlorinated. The table J1 in Appendix J has a list and summary of mitigation methods, so that's probably the best place to find that. But in general, as far as engineering controls go, they're going to be pretty much the same as you'd use for chlorinated solvents. The gold standard being subslab depressurization, and then a variety of other things you can do if that isn't the best option.
In modeling, what algorithms are used to calculate the diffusion rate?
The effective diffusion coefficient is based on an empirical relationship called Millington and Quirk, and it just relates the effective diffusion coefficient to the water-filled and total porosity, as well as for the soluble component or aqueous phase component, the Henry's law constant.
Are compositional coupling effects considered in models commonly used today?
Well, there's some great modeling questions here. Compositional coupling effects, I'm trying to think what that could be. First of all, I mean, on the models that are typically used for VI, Johnson and Yanager, are models that are based on chemical transport via diffusion, and as I indicated, advection and diffusion across the building envelope. They're not compositional models with respect to NAPL. They don't account for any NAPL migration. They don't account for the typical models for density effects or other factors like that. So really when we, I think, are getting into those kinds of, and I'm speculating a bit here, but compositional or multi-phase or models like that, maybe including density or temperature, we're dealing with pretty sophisticated numerical models that generally aren't used for VI. But I'm always interested in hearing of whether there are folks out there who are considering using such models. So, and perhaps there is some knowledge out there that would be worth sharing.
From the Q&A, I read studies that suggest barometric pressure can influence rates of vapor intrusion, resulting in highly variable concentration levels in indoor air, even during a 24-hour period.
And there's been some work on that. Conceptually, the potential for barometric pumping to affect vapor intrusion increases with very thick vadal zones and highly permeable soil. So there are references and some data out there for example, a vadal zone is several hundred feet thick that's a fractured rock where there is significant advective movement. That would fall in the precluding factor category, and you'd certainly want to assess that site on a site-specific basis and better understand those processes. But the typical sites where your water tables are, I would say, anywhere between, you know, 10, 20, 30, and 40 feet below ground surface, where you have your typical sandy or maybe silty or fine-grained soils, we really don't see evidence for barometric pumping being a real significant process that affects vapor intrusion, the rate of vapor intrusion. If you were to collect a very shallow soil gas sample, which is not necessarily advisable, you may see some influence of pumping, and certainly that would need to be considered, but that's kind of a different case. So, I'm not sure where those observations have occurred. Certainly, if you had landfills, if there's been observations of barometric pumping for surface fluxes. So again, that's a bit of a different case, though.
Thank you. We are out of questions submitted online. So if you have a question and we haven't got to it yet, you can email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we'll follow up with trainers after today's class for answers for those questions. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you haven't already, please fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information not only to help improve today's training course, but we also develop new training courses, and we can use your feedback to help our trainers do better at providing new training courses for you. More information about ITRC is on the website, www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.